We are all called, as you know, to be peacemakers. In fact, one of our primary responsibilities, you might say, in the millennium might be to teach peace. There's not one group today that we can think of, at least I can't think of, large or small, that's not in need of peace and the knowledge of how to have peace. We think of the news constantly. We think of the nation of Israel, and the Palestinians, and somebody might actually say it's really Hamas that they've got problems with. That's subsided a little bit lately, but still, the Middle East as a whole, we got problems there, not very much peace. We have India and Pakistan, always up and down with where they're at as relationships go. We have, national government. We've got Democrats and Republicans and different opinions always sort of duking it out. There's not very much peace. Maybe in your own neighborhood, possibly in our own town, you have lack of peace. People are at odds. People are fighting. And sometimes, sadly, even in the family, our own families, we have lack of peace and conflict. And even in the church, we find ourselves sometimes in a conflict. But being a peacemaker is valuable, something that God values. In fact, in Matthew 5:9, if you want to jot that down, it says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, who will be called the sons of God." Peace is also a part of God's character. In 1 Thessalonians 5:23, I'm not going to just read these, you can jot them down. Paul refers to God as the God of peace, the God of peace. And in fact, many times in the New Testament, God is referred to as the God of peace. And I count at least 5 times in the New Testament. Isaiah 9:6, Christ is referred to as the Prince of Peace. We're also told to have peace with one another. In 2 Corinthians 13:11, Paul says, "Finally, brethren," and he's ending up here in 2 Corinthians 2:13-11. He says, "Finally, brethren, farewell. Become complete. Be of good comfort. Be of one mind. Live in peace, and the God of peace will be with you." So we're told to have peace with one another. And we reflect God when we have peace with one another. In 1 Corinthians 14:33, it says, "God is not the author of confusion, but he's the author of peace, as in all the churches of the saints." So the churches of the saints will have peace. Today I would like to focus on our role as peacemakers and the principles of being a peacemaker now. And a lot of the content, or some of the content I'm using, comes from a book called The Peacemaker. I think we've used that in the past. Mr. Fay has referenced that book. But the book, The Peacemaker by Ken Sandy, a lot of the content will come from there. But 3 principles I'd like to focus on of peace to help us have peace are, first, start with yourself, 2, reconcile, and 3, forgive. The principles will specifically apply to really church members, people that are fellow church members and called out and have the Holy Spirit. But you can take many of the ideas and apply them to different environments like work or school. But some ideas probably wouldn't work so well. And one example might be when we later on might talk about Matthew 18:15. If you're having a conflict with somebody and you it says go to the church, obviously if you can't bring a coworker, and have him talk to Mr. Fay, right, and have him resolve the problem, right? So, but the ideas, a lot of the ideas can work, and principles can work and in other environments, but specifically I'm talking about within the church. And I do think it's good to review this, and sometimes I think it's good to just stop for a minute and recognize that it's not strange that conflicts do occur in the church. It does happen. If it does happen, we shouldn't get be surprised by that if occasionally there's a conflict. But the key is that it doesn't continue. But let's turn to Philippians. I'd like to just show you that there is conflict at times and they do need to be addressed. Turn to Philippians 4. This is why, Philippians 4 and verse 1, and this is Paul talking to Philippians and the church in Philippi, and he's addressing them directly. It says in verse 1, "Therefore, my beloved and longed for brethren, my joy and crown, so stand fast in the Lord, beloved. I implore Euodia and I implore Syntyche to be of the same mind in the Lord. And I urge you also, true companions, help these women who labored with me in the gospel, with Clement also, and the rest of my fellow workers whose names are in the book of life." So there's not a lot of detail here, but there's a situation here that Paul's aware of, that these two women aren't getting along. He doesn't give us the detail what it is, but what's interesting that he calls them, these are two women that have helped him in preaching the gospel. They've been very involved. And he's asking them to be of one mind, but he's also urging the congregation to help them. So he's saying, well, obviously this has come to Paul's attention. The people in the congregation know there's a situation going on, and he's telling them directly in this letter that they need to be of the same mind, and he's also asking the congregation to help and assist in resolving what's going on here. So we all have to have knowledge. We're all knowing how to be a peacemaker, knowing how to help others be peaceful and resolve conflict is something that is useful, not just in the millennium, but now. When we see people having conflict, maybe we'll be called upon to help out and to assist in that situation. So the first principle that I wanted to focus on is, let's look at ourselves first of all. If there's a conflict that needs to be resolved, there's something that's going on in our lives where there's stress, the first step for any successful peacemaker is to first look at their own role in the conflict. I once heard a story about a 5-year-old boy. His name was Andrew. While visiting a neighbor with his parents, Andrew pulled out his kindergarten class picture and immediately began describing each classmate. He said, "This is Robert. He hits everyone. This is Stephen. He never listens to the teacher. And this is Mark. He chases us and is very noisy." Pointing to his own picture, Andrew commented, "And this is me. I'm just sitting here minding my own business." Oftentimes, you look at conflict that way, don't we? That everybody else is doing this to us, and they're doing things to me, and I'm just minding my own business. Well, most times it's not like that. Instead of looking at what somebody else is doing initially, we should look at how we participated in the conflict, what we've done. Maybe we participated in it. Maybe somebody really is fully at fault, but let's look at our own situation, how we may have participated in it. Maybe we helped it get escalated. Maybe our words didn't help calm things down. Maybe someone else initiated it. But we probably, and I can't think of any situation that I can think of where I've had a conflict, an issue at work, or anything where I've been truly 100% innocent. So the first principle we find in Matthew 7. If you want to turn there with me, Matthew 7. Starting verse 3, it says, "And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, 'Let me remove the speck from your eye,' and look, a plank is in your own eye? Hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye." So here we see a principle that we want to apply in this case, that we should clearly look at our own shortcomings. Where do we fall short in the conflict? If we are in a conflict or have an issue or we're just in a fight, it's really a situation, again, that none of us had zero part to play in. It always takes generally two to tango. Again, I can't honestly think of one situation where I found myself in a situation where I was at odds and striving with somebody where I was totally innocent. And maybe you can come up with one for yourself, but for myself, I can't. I think most of you would probably buy that. In most cases, we have some part to play. So we have a conflict or fight or something going on. Let's look at the source. It's good to always look at the source of the problem. We agreed to look at ourselves. Why do we have this fight? What part do we play? And it's good to look at our own hearts. What is it that is in our hearts that maybe is causing us to be at odds or having a difficult situation with somebody? A good place to start is James 4, James 4 and verse 1. And we'll start there and just look at a concept that I think we've heard many times that we'll review of why we oftentimes find ourselves at odds and in fights and in conflicts. So in James 4 and verse 1, James says, "Now where do wars and fights come from among you?" It's a good question. He obviously is addressing some congregation. There's some fights, there's some wars, is he calling them? Squabbles. Where are they coming from? "Do they not come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust and you do not have, you murder and you covet and you cannot obtain, you fight in war." Generally speaking, if we have an issue with somebody or something, it usually comes down to what James says right here. There's a desire. We want something very badly. You know, we want, you know, we begin to have thoughts that are dominated about what we want, or covetousness. And when we want something and feel we can't be satisfied unless we get it, the desire starts to control us, doesn't it? And if others start to get in our way, we start to focus on what we can't get, and why we can't have it, and we start to fight harder to get what we want. There's obviously a progression that starts out and it causes problems. First, as we said, it starts with desire. We often desire something. Sometimes it can be even a good desire. But somehow we think this desire will make us happy or content. And we begin to dwell on that desire. And we even begin to justify it in our hearts that it'd be good and worthwhile. And then we often go to the next level. We start to think, well, this desire is good. We should have it. And we start to think, well, I really am starting to really need that. And we start having deeper emotions about that desire. And we often start to moving to desire to demand. We're starting to even demand that we have something. We determine that we deserve a desire and start to demand. And maybe things like, you know, I've got things in work context, but you can use different examples. But we start to think of, like, I deserve that raise. I really do. Not only there's nothing wrong to desire a raise or a promotion, but then you start thinking, I deserve that raise. And I'm starting to even demand it. And, you know, these desires go unmet. We get more frustrated. And then we begin to think about, we go to the, like, what I'm calling the judgment stage. We start to judge others for getting in our way. Maybe our boss is getting in our way. Or maybe somebody else is getting what we want. You know, we start to think in our minds, you know, going back to that work context, you know, my coworker, she only got that promotion because she eats lunch with the boss every week. And you start to think, well, that's a judgment call. You know, and she's stopping me. If she wasn't doing this, if she didn't get special preference, I would be the one getting that raise or that promotion. And then we start thinking about people that are in our way, they're stopping us from getting what we want, and we start to think about how we can get back at them, cause pain to them, maybe interfere in their lives, and stopping us, and then we go back to the original, well, if I only had this desire, I'd be happy. We start to punish people that are in our way. That's often what, you know, that's kind of a summary, a little expansion of summary of James 4, but it all starts with desires, and those desires go unmet and expands till we start acting out on deeper emotions, thinking we deserve that. And as James says, it leads to fights and wars among us when we can't get what we want. So we should always look at ourselves. We look at our heart, first of all, when we're in our conflict, see where we play a part. I also wanted to just mention a few other good principles if we find ourselves in a conflict that help us maybe avoid conflict or avoid situations. And one principle is just, first of all, overlook minor offenses. Before we start to address other people and their part, we might just want to look and see, is this even worth addressing? And I think if that worked, there starts to be things that rub me the wrong way about what somebody did or what somebody they're insinuating certain things, or at least I'm putting that to their comments. And oftentimes, I decide, basically on the scripture, just to overlook that offense. Well, maybe they didn't mean that by it. And just instead of addressing every issue, just overlook it if it's minor. In Proverbs 19:11, it says, "The discretion of a man makes him slow to anger, and his glory is to overlook a transgression." Another translation says it a little differently. "A man's wisdom gives him patience. It is to his glory to overlook an offense." Proverbs 23 says, "It is honorable for a man to stop striving, since any fool can start a quarrel." So oftentimes, you know, we find ourselves in a conflict, or we are about to start a bigger conflict. Maybe we just want to overlook that offense. Proverbs 17:14 says, "The beginning of strife is like releasing water. Therefore, stop contention before a quarrel starts." Another translation says it a little differently that maybe sheds a little bit more light on this. It says, "Starting a quarrel is like breaching a dam. So drop the matter before a dispute breaks out." It's liking it as if you really want to create a big issue, then open up the dam and all the water will come out, and then you've got a big problem. So we should definitely, before we start addressing people that we are in conflict with or think there's a conflict, we should definitely stop, first of all, and make sure that, is it worth even addressing? Maybe it's worth overlooking. It's a minor offense. But we should ask ourselves, when should we not ignore an offense or a problem that's occurring? Well, there's several principles that we can look at. Maybe we do need to address, go to the next step and address somebody directly about a conflict or a problem we find ourselves in. And when would that be? Well, there's several situations. One is when a situation is visible and serious enough that it reflects poorly on the church or ultimately God. If something is going on in the church where obviously people are being impacted by it, people know that there's a situation, then you definitely need to reconcile that with that person or begin to figure out, okay, this is a problem I've got to resolve. It's not shedding good light on the church, and ultimately it doesn't reflect well on God's people and God himself. So that's one reason why you might want to go to the next level and address a conflict with a person. Next, is it damaging your relationship? Is it damaging your relationship? If you're unable, what do I mean by that? If you're unable to forgive an offense, you have feelings or thoughts or words or actions towards other people that have altered and not changed over time, you need to maybe address that with that person. You know, if you're unable to forgive that person as an offense, whatever reason that you have to, that isn't able to, you're able to forgive or look past, and it's starting to cause an obvious problem with you and that person, you should address that. Another principle is it hurting others? Is it hurting others? If you see something going on and you're realizing it's definitely hurting other people or other things, or possibly it's hurting the offender. Maybe you're aware of something that only the person isn't hurting anybody else, but they're hurting themselves. Maybe you need that's something worth addressing. So first principle is look at yourself. So it's a good place to start. Next, we want to talk about reconcile. How do we reconcile? We want to begin reconciling. God doesn't expect problems and conflicts to exist in the church. So we are called upon to reconcile with people in the church. It was a conflict. It can't go on. Let's turn to Matthew 18:15. We simply see principles up here how to deal with that. And again, after we look at ourselves and we see that we've addressed our own issues where we may have played a part, we might very well realize, okay, I've looked at myself, and the next step is that even after looking at myself, I've got to go and address the conflict with this person, what's going on, and talk to them about their role in the conflict. They're not helping this out, or they're doing something that's seriously wrong, and they need to make sure that they understand how they're contributing to this problem. In Matthew 18 and verse 15, we see this instruction. It says, "Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you have gained your brother." So here we see the conflict. There's some principles here. It says you and him alone, which means you're not really meant to go and involve a lot of people at this point in time. Don't tell a lot of people this. Like, I've got a problem with this person, and I'm going to go to this person alone directly. And the outcome, if it works out well, is that you've gained a brother. Now, let's talk about this scripture a little bit more in the context in which we find the scripture. Often we take this scripture as confronting somebody. We really need to read the previous verses and the context of where this is placed to really understand, you know, what's the context in which we are supposed to confront somebody, address somebody. And I think it's interesting to think, and I've never heard it explained this way too often, but if you turn to Matthew 18, if you're there already, and in verse 12, we see what's before this instruction. In Matthew 12, sorry, 18 and verse 12, it says, it's interesting to see what's before this instruction. Verse 12 says, "What do you think? If a man has 100 sheep and one of them goes astray, does he not leave 99 and go to the mountains to seek the one that is straying? And if he should find it, assuredly, I say to you, he rejoices more over that sheep than over the 99 that did not go astray. Even so, it is not the will of your Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish." So right before we're given this instruction to go directly to our brother or sister, this is right before it in between 12 and 14 about the idea of Christ being like a shepherd and going and getting the lost sheep and restoring the sheep back into the fold. And I think that's something, when we do go to our brother, if we have a conflict, we have something we have to resolve, we have to go in that same attitude. This person's obviously there's a conflict, there's something that's causing issues in the church, possibly restoring that person back into the fold and reconciling back the relationship is really the context here. It's not confronting head on and telling them directly, "You're wrong, I'm right," but it's the care and concern that you have about this person who is maybe not doing something correct or right, and you're trying to restore the relationship back into the fold. We're also reminded, if you look at later on in Matthew 18 and verse 21, what's also placed in right after this is the parable of the unmerciful steward. And I think we all know this parable, but it's a parable who was of a steward who was forgiven of a little debt, but yet he didn't forgive others of their debts. He was very hard on them. So again, we go to somebody in the same mindset that we realize that we've been forgiven by God, and when we go to somebody else, we want to make sure that we realize we want to have the same attitude that we've been forgiven, and we need to approach them the same way. So again, it's important that when following Matthew 18 and verse 15, that the attitude is approached as though someone is restoring a relationship. You want to restore it. You want to reconcile. So what are some principles of approaching someone? It says approach someone, go to your brother as instructed. How do we do that? You know, there's probably some good ways and some bad ways of how to do this. I'd just like to, from a practical perspective, just go over some ways in which we can approach someone if we need to in a conflict. And this is more of a practical instruction. But if you need to go to somebody, as in Matthew 18 and 15, let's look at some ways in which it may be on the right track for success. First principle is, when you're approaching somebody, is you want to choose the right time and place. You want to choose the right time and place. And timing is actually a very essential ingredient. It's not often a good time to address someone or talk to someone when they're tired, they're worried, and they're in a bad mood. I know, although my wife will say there is no good time for me, but there are worse times than others, like coming home from a rough day at work and addressing why I've done something not the best way. It's tough for me to, I'm not as open-minded possibly, and maybe, not that it ever happens, of course, but you know, but I think we all can put ourselves in that situation where we are more open to hearing about something than others. So if you have to address somebody, or you've chosen to do that, you really want to pick the right time and place. You want to make sure there's a place where you can talk freely. You're not going to be interrupted. You know, if somebody here at church, you know, it's not a good time, you know, 2 seconds after church next to the food table. It's chaos back there, right? You know, and people are running around trying to get food, and that's probably not a great place to try to talk to somebody about something serious like this. So you want to find a place that's quiet, free of distractions, and a place that both of you feel comfortable and relaxed and secure. I often think in this case of Esther. Esther was a very very careful to pick the right place to talk to the king. First of all, if you remember the story, she needed to talk to the king, and she waited very patiently to talk about it and waited for the right occasion, and then asked for a banquet, and then she waited till the second day of the banquet when things were just right, and then she approached the king with the situation at hand, and he was much more open-minded. But can you think if the king was in the middle of dealing with some conflict with his the princes or whoever were running the country, and there was a possible conflict, and they were upset, and they were fighting. She waited for just the right time to address him, you know, and talk to him about the situation. So that's a very important principle. Another one is talk in person whenever possible. Face-to-face is always better, if possible, versus a telephone. Facial expressions and body language can't be seen over the phone. Now, wrong assumptions can be made when you can't see other people's reactions. Maybe you're in a phone conversation. Oftentimes, somebody's saying, yes, I agree, but if you were there in person, that individual might be, through their body language, you're realizing they're not really agreeing, they're not really with you on this one, they're upset, and they're just saying the right thing to get off the phone and get off and move on. I think of just imagine if they had cell phones and texting back in the day of David. You know, can you imagine how well it would have gone when Abigail, I think everybody knows the story of Abigail, was coming to David. What if she was texting David, I'm sorry, and you know, maybe you can just overlook this trespass and move on. And what did she do? She came all the way out to see David. She bowed down and prostrated herself towards him. And in 1 Samuel 25 and verse 23, you can read that if you want. But she came, and David could see not only by her words, but by her body language of how she what she was communicating. So talk in person whenever possible. That's always going to make it go better. And, number three, plan your words. Plan your words is very important. Carefully planning your words can be the difference in restoring peace or increasing hostility. I don't know how many times I've tried to explain something to my wife, and I end up getting myself in worse situations because I don't plan my words well, and if I would have thought things through a little better, I would have used better words that would have sounded better to her. And maybe you can think of situations like that. So planning your words very carefully. And you may even want to write out your words if it's a very serious situation and saying the wrong thing is definitely not going to be helpful. You may want to write out your words. You may want to define the issue clearly and make sure you don't have minor details that aren't important. Sometimes it's good to know if people might understand something better if you use analogies or metaphors. That may help people understand what you're trying to help them understand better. A description of the effect of the problem that you're having with one another, that may be helpful. And if possible, maybe in writing out your words or thinking out your words, have a suggestion or preference for a solution to a problem. Oftentimes, I have people come to me and they can describe the problem very well. It goes way better when they can actually say, here's the problem and here's a possible solution. And this occurs in this situation as well. If you see a situation, maybe you can come with a solution. And you may also want to come with a benefit that will come from solving this problem and cooperating with the solution. So obviously, it's like the win-win. Everybody wants to know how they can benefit from solving the situation and have a benefit. Also, you want to be objective. Keep remarks as objective as possible. Personal perceptions and feelings may not be helpful. Try not to exaggerate. I know a lot of times I've said, you always do something, or you never. And that's not often the case. It's not always. It's not never. So you try not to exaggerate. For example, it might be good to say, you were late for work 5 times in the last 2 weeks versus you're always late for work. If you're trying to address the situation with someone being late to work, you know, be specific, 5 times. But if you say always, the person's always going to say, well, I wasn't late yesterday and I wasn't late on Tuesday. But 5 times helps address the problem specifically and helps it be objective. Another principle is, if we're going to use the Bible, use the Bible carefully. You want to be very careful about using the Bible. And it says in Ephesians 4:29, it says, let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. So you don't want to use the Bible to beat somebody up over the head with what they're doing. You may want to use it to illustrate something or show maybe a principle. But keep, you know, if you don't use the Bible, use the passage for its intended purposes. Don't stretch the passage for outside the context. And know when to stop. It can be very irritating to keep hearing scriptures poured out in front of you why you're wrong. You know, if you're not, you may want to be very careful how long you keep going on with using the Bible if you're going to use the Bible. And then again, you may want to ask for feedback. You know, would ask them if they agree with what you've said. What would they disagree with? You know, have I confused you? Have I explained myself well enough? And again, and going on, you might want to offer solutions and preferences to the conflict, and also recognize your limits. You recognize you can only go so far. You can only raise concerns, suggestions, or solutions, or encourage reasonable thinking, but you can't force someone to change. So at some point, you got to realize you can't only go so far. So this is, again, with going one-on-one with a person, you got to go directly and address the situation. What if that doesn't work? You know, what if the issue or conflict is still unresolved, the other party involved isn't addressing their part in the role, in fact, maybe they're becoming more belligerent, maybe they're becoming more defiant, they're not understanding that they're causing major harm to you or somebody else. Let's look at what we're supposed to do then. Matthew 18, verse 16 goes further. It says, but if he refuses to hear, take with you one or more, that by the mouth of 2 or 3 witnesses, every word may be established. Again, if the conflict is with a fellow church member, you may ask a respected third or fourth person who both parties respect and are going to listen to bring them in and to the conversation. While you're dealing with this individual, the person you're having conflict with, you may want to say something like this before you even bring the third or fourth person in. It says, Mary, for example, you might say something like this, Mary, I would prefer to resolve this matter just between the two of us. Since that has not happened, and because this involves issues that are too important to walk away from, my only other option is to obey what the Bible commands, which means asking Alice and Jennifer to help us out. I would rather that you go together to get help, but if I need to, I will go by myself. So here is an approach you may want to take with somebody if you're not getting very far with them one-on-one, and you're letting them know, okay, if we're not going to solve this between ourselves, I've got to bring somebody else into this. That possibly may encourage them just to solve it between the two individuals. But if you don't, then you're letting them know that you're going to get help from outside to an outside source. So again, the Bible goes on to gives us further instruction. We actually try these two things. If it's so bad and the person's being belligerent, not hearing you, and you're doing all the right things, you addressed your own issues. Let's see what it says in verse 17 of Matthew 18. it says, and if he refused to hear them, so you brought a third or fourth person, or a second or third person into this, tell it to the church. But if he refuses even to hear the church, let him be with you, be to you like a heathen and a tax collector. This means you're just going to realize this person's not converted, probably doesn't have the Holy Spirit, and isn't going to listen to anything else. Doesn't mean you write that person off as a person. Just realize that this, you're probably dealing with an unconverted person. But sometimes you may have to ask the minister for help to with the goal of you want to restore the relationship. And if the other person does not respond, then the minister has to make some judgment. And he may realize this person necessarily isn't really part of us, isn't interested in hearing what they're doing wrong. And conflicts in the church have to be resolved. Ultimately, hopefully, I don't think this happens very often, but when conflicts get so obvious to everybody and there's issues in the church, it's the minister's responsibility to ultimately to help reconcile the two people. The minister isn't allowed to leave conflict going on in the church. Again, God's not the author of confusion, but of peace, and the churches of the saints have peace. So although we do have conflicts at times, it can't stay in that situation for ongoing without some resolution. Conflicts between members can't be left to fester or not be addressed. Again, we've got to have the idea that we want to restore back and reconcile the relationship. That's really a command, isn't it? If you look at Matthew 5, verse 23, if you want to turn there, Matthew 5, it's really a command to us that we have to deal with conflicts that we have with one another in the church. In Matthew 5, verse 23, I think this has been used several times in the last 4 or 5 months, but I'll read it to you. Matthew 5 and verse 23, it says, therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, and I can think of this as like, say we're about to do an offering at church on a holy day, and then you remember that your brother has something against you. You know that this person really is kind of annoyed with you. You know that you actually have done something to them and they're annoyed. It says what? Leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. So it's very clear that God wants us to be reconciled to one another. Some situations take longer to resolve, but they can't go unresolved forever. They have to be dealt with. Matthew 18 is a goal to restore a relationship, and it's in the context of restoring as gently as possible, like a shepherd finding a lost sheep. Again, we also want to remember, in approaching others, we want to remember how merciful God has been to us. Whenever somebody's done something to us, we always want to keep in mind all the things that God has been very merciful in us, and we want to be merciful in the same way towards this other person. Doesn't mean we should ignore the offense or not deal with it, but we want to be merciful in how we do it. So now I'd like to go on to the next principle, the principle of forgiveness. We talked about looking at ourselves first, and then if required, approaching with the goal of restoring. If we're going to approach somebody, we want to do it with the right approach of restoring and reconciling that relationship. And the next step is fully forgiving the other person. Now, this is a tough one, I have to admit. Oftentimes, we may find ourselves able to do the first two, right? We look at ourselves, we realize, okay, I'm not perfect here. I got something to deal with. And two, I still got to deal with the situation and address the other person. But the next thing is really fully forgiving and completely reconciling. That's the tough one. It's tough. And it's not humanly really possible, I'll tell you that right now. It does require God's help. But we are told to forgive. We are told to forgive. In Colossians 3, in verse 13, Colossians 3, verse 13, it says, therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another. Right there, there's the implication that if you bear with one another, that there's going to be strife sometimes with fellow brethren. But you bear with one another and forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. It's not a nice thought. It's a command. You must do this. We must forgive. Now, let's talk about what forgiveness is not before we go further. Forgiveness is not a feeling. You can't make yourself want to forgive somebody. I don't know if you tried that before. It's humanly, at least for me, you know, who really likes forgiving somebody? If they've done something, let's say they've done something pretty bad to you as well. You know, it's not like they, didn't look at you and scowled at you as you passed them. Let's, you know, they've done something pretty serious. And they knowingly did it. It's hard to forgive that, isn't it? It's not in our own human makeup to want to forgive. We want justice. We want get that. So forgiveness is not a feeling. It's not something you don't make yourself feel that you want to do. Forgiveness is also not forgetting. It's not, what I mean by that, it's not the, well, if enough time goes by, I'll forget about this and I'll, by default, sort of forgive the person. No, it's not just, you know, letting it go in the past. We have to move on, but forgiveness is not just forgetting about it and letting time go by to the point that we forget about it and it's not in the forefront of our mind. And it's also, forgiveness is not excusing. It's not excusing. Saying, well, it's okay what that one person did. Excusing means someone really didn't do anything. If someone's really done something wrong, you just can't excuse and say, well, they really didn't do it or minimize it. If they've done something, they've done something, and minimizing it is not forgiveness. Forgiveness is not minimizing what they've done and trying to excuse it. True forgiveness that leads to having a reconciliation is not easy. But let's review some of God's attitude on forgiveness, as it's helpful to help us understand how we should forgive others. Let's look at what God says about forgiveness, and then we can use that as how we can pattern our own attitude. In Jeremiah 31 and verse 34, it says, "For I will forgive their iniquity and their sin. I will remember no more." In Psalm 103 and verse 12, it says, "As far as the east is from the west, so far as he removed our transgressions from us." So then this is the attitude God has towards us. When he forgives us, it's like the sins are gone. Psalm 130 and verse 3 through 4 says, "If you, Lord, should mark iniquities or remember them or put them down like an accountant would do, like, don't put them down. Oh, Lord, who would stand? But there is forgiveness with you that you may be feared." Again, we're reminded that all of us are guilty. All of us, if God's keeping track, right, if God was to keep track of everything that we did, like an accountant every time, writing it down, nobody would stand. We'd all, you know, fall short. But regardless of how guilty we are about, he forgives us, right? And that we may be feared, that he may be feared. Forgiveness plays a vital role in having peace. In the book called Lee, The Last Years, by Charles Bracelin, the story goes that after the war, General Lee, and those who know about the Civil War, I mean, that was a brutal war, brother against brother. There was huge tensions and conflicts and very deep emotional rifts between families and the whole nation. And it was actually a very sad time in our country. And General Lee was, as we all know, the general of the losing side, the southern side. This is what he says. "After the war, General Lee visited a lady in Kentucky. The lady took Lee to see the remains of a grand old tree in front of her house. There she bitterly cried over the tree's limbs and trunk that had been destroyed by the Norse artillery fire. She looked to Lee for some comforting words or even a condemning word to the North. But after a brief silence, Lee said, 'Cut it down, my dear madam, and forget it. It is better to forgive the injustices of the past than to allow them to remain. Let bitterness take root and poison the rest of your life.'" So for us to have peace, we really do have to move on sometimes, forgive others for what they've done. We can't hold on to bitterness and just be constantly bitter and angry at what somebody did. We eventually, to have true peace in our own lives, have to forgive the individuals. And in a church context, in an ideal Matthew 18 situation, both sides and the person maybe that has offended and caused conflict, there's repentance. And it's nice if it would work out where this person repents and you forgive the person and you can go on. That's the ideal situation. But sometimes people don't see their part. They don't choose to address their problems. But you still have to have the attitude of forgiveness to that person. So you can have peace. You've got to have peace internally, and the only way to do that is ultimately to forgive. It does take power to forgive. I mean, it takes God's power to forgive, and it does come from God. And then we do have to call on God's help sometimes to give us the power to forgive. There's a story of Corrie Ten Boom. I'm not sure if everybody knows her. Maybe some of the younger generation knows her and is aware of her. I remember as a school child reading her account. But she was a young, I think she's from the Netherlands. Her family was put in a concentration camp for helping Jews. And she watched her own father and I think sister die in a concentration camp. But she was known for, once she got out of the concentration camp, the war was over, she went on to preach about the power of forgiveness. And she preached in many churches, or she spoke in many churches about forgiving. And one day after church, when she spoke about forgiving and God's love and the power of forgiveness in her life to be able to move on, she came in contact with one of the guards that participated in killing her family. And the guard came up to her and was acknowledging her message and how wonderful it was that God's love allowed someone like Ken to be forgiven, and just very acknowledging her message. And he went to reach out and shake her hand, and she wouldn't shake his hand back. And she realized, you know, at that point, you know, the power to forgive comes from God. She had to pray three times to have the power to forgive this man, and she ultimately did shake his hand, and she immediately felt, you know, an overwhelming sense of relief and peace between this individual and herself. Because she realized, and I think we all realize that, again, forgiveness like that, that's, I don't think anybody's faced anything like that, at least I haven't, seeing someone participate in the death of your family members. But that's what God faced, didn't he? God faced the fact that his own son died, and he forgave every one of us who participated in that. And that power, that strength to forgive like that, only can come from God. It doesn't come from us humanly. If you try to, we can't work up forgiveness, true forgiveness by ourselves. That comes from God. And that's really where it comes from. So we do need to move on to have true peace. We need to forgive. And we always need to ask God for that power and that instruction to be able to forgive people that have hurt us. So, brethren, peacemaking is a big job. It's something that we are called to do today, and we need to have training and commitment to be peacemakers. Peacemakers is what God expects and what he will use to bring peace when he returns. I think oftentimes we think of the millennium as a situation where there'll be the absence of war, because God's sitting there and Christ is sitting there making sure that nobody is fighting, and that definitely is the case. But peacemaking is more than just stopping people from fighting, making sure that nobody goes to war. Peacemaking is reconciling relationships and forgiveness. Peace comes first, you know, looking at our own role and addressing how we contribute to the conflict and the problem. If we can't overlook the offense, the other party should, and we need to have the other person address their role in the conflict, we should approach that person, or that individual or party, with the attitude of wanting them to be restored back and have a relationship as in a gentle way, like the shepherd restores a sheep to the flock. For members of the church, we can follow Matthew 18 and verse 15 as a process for helping restore relationship. But the next step ultimately of that is truly moving on and having a true reconciliation and forgiveness. Because truly, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God.